This is Onward Nation, episode 572.
Get ready to find your recipe for success from America's top business owners here at Onward Nation with your host, Stephen Wessner.
Good morning, Onward Nation. I'm Stephen Wessner, and welcome to episode number 572. Now, today we're going to start off maybe a little bit different, and maybe you've already heard, I have a new book called Profitable Podcasting, and I am so excited because my publisher gave me the green light to give away a free chapter. Awesome. And I want you to know just quickly how you can get it. So if you go to onwardnation.com/free chapter, no spaces, just onwardnation.com/free chapter, you'll get the chapter where I show you how to confront and overcome your three biggest obstacles to success. Again, that is onwardnation.com/free chapter, and we will send it right to your inbox. Now let's welcome today's guest, Kendall Lyman. Kendall is the author of Change the Way You Change, and is a founding principal of the Highlands Group, which is a firm specializing in strategy, organizational change, and leadership development. He helps leaders around the world to navigate change, improve employee engagement, and transform culture. Kendall has consulted with a wide array of organizations, ranging from Fortune 500 to small and mid-sized firms. Welcome to Onward Nation, Kendall.
Thank you, Stephen. It's an honor to be with you, and hello, Onward Nation.
Well, it is an honor to have you here, and thank you for accepting my invitation. But your bio, extremely impressive, but it is just a thin slice into you and your background and as a leader, business owner. So take us behind the green curtain and tell us more about you and your journey and path, and then we'll dive in with the questions.
Absolutely, Stephen. I've been listening to your show for a while now, and I'm always interested and fascinated by your guests and how their journey got them where they are today. And so I've done a little bit of reflection on some of my own turning points maybe over the last 25 years and had an opportunity to reflect a little bit. I've lived in different countries, in Japan, in England, in Chile, and those experiences exposed me really to different cultures and got me interested in how to work with people and how to solve problems. So I went to college and thought that I was going to major in international marketing, and did that, and then worked for IBM for several years and became fascinated in how organizations work. So I went back to graduate school and earned an MBA from Brigham Young University, focused on strategy, operations, and human behavior. And in my career, I've worked with many different consulting firms, a strategy consulting boutique, an organization design firm, a leadership development firm before starting the Highlands Group. And in each of those, it felt a bit like I became a hammer searching for a nail, so to speak. It was like I was offering a single solution to complex business problems. And I started wondering, is this how it felt to be a leader of an organization where you're often tinkering with tactics while hoping for transformation? And so today what I do is I work with leaders to increase their own capacity and their own leadership. It has to start there. I create clarity and focus in the organization. I'm really looking for holistic organizational internal alignment solutions, if you'd call it that. It sounds kind of jargony, but that's what we do. And then helping engage leaders. And what I have found that's the only way over the last 25 years that I can find complete solutions, because they have to be at the individual, team, and organizational level. And so that's what I do. I do some consulting, I do some coaching, I do some leadership development to help leaders figure out how to increase their own business performance.
Well, I love how you wove in, actually started with one of your main points here when you said increase their own capacity as a leader. And I put that right into my notes and thought, okay, now that's interesting. And so I mean, maybe there's a couple of, and this probably doesn't do it justice, but maybe there's a couple of tips or strategies, probably strategies is the better way to describe that. Like how, if somebody is interested, one of our Onward Nation business owners listening to you right now, somebody's interested in increasing their own capacity as a leader, what might be a couple of ways that they can begin to approach that?
What are the skills that I see leaders who trip after a certain point is their lack of self-awareness. And the question I often ask my clients is, what is it like to be on the receiving end of you? And many of us don't really know. We're so busy running the business. We're so busy creating alliances and developing strategy and trying to operate the business that we don't slow down long enough to ask that question. So a simple way is just purely ask the question, but be really specific. How did I show up in that last meeting? What is it like when I'm angry? When I'm speaking well, what do you see? So you're looking for specific behaviors. Another tool that we use a lot, in fact, we're working with an organization right now where they asked us to help them with their rollout of a new customer service platform. We did some strategy work. We did some mission and vision work. But it wasn't until we had them do a 360-degree survey where they looked at each other and discovered that maybe there was some things in the mirror that they didn't quite like, first of all. And then second of all, they discovered as we did the aggregate survey that there were some things that weren't working at their senior leadership team level that they didn't have the courage yet to discuss. So both of those things helped them look at themselves and then look at their relations to each other through a simple 360, and there's a lot of them out there you can use, but it helps shine the mirror on what's maybe working and maybe what's getting in your own way.
Yeah, great metaphor, shine the mirror. I like how you started that piece off there too, where you mentioned, you know, how do you know how others experience you? Where often that tends to be a blind spot for most of us, doesn't it?
It really does. It really does. We don't take the time, or we don't have the courage, or we don't have some trusted advisors, really, especially when you're a leader at the top. Many won't have the courage or the ability to tell things how they are. And so you've got to find some trusted advisors that will give you unvarnished feedback, because that's the only way you're going to grow. And I like the word capacity, maybe even more than capability. We talk about capability as skill sets and abilities, and you can do this and you can do that. Capacity is even bigger. It's your ability to deal with change. It's your ability to handle setback. It's resiliency. It's how you can leverage yourself. And so if you're not looking at your own capacity, and then second of all, looking at the capacity of your senior leadership team, that's really going to be the governor of your own business performance in those two factors right there.
This is fantastic. Great way to really give us an orientation to not only your expertise, but the things that really matter to you and the problems that you and your team are working so hard to solve. This is fantastic. I know that we're going to be able to weave in a lot more of this as we continue with our conversation. Let's dive into this first section that I like to call focus and preparation. Preparation, because it's so true that greatness is available to all of us if we're willing to do the common things uncommonly well, which is a powerful lesson that I learned from one of my mentors, Don Yeager. So, Kendall, let's start off with, well, maybe there's a secret or maybe there's a time-saving technique that you can share with us that helps you focus and prepare to tackle your most vital priorities each day.
Boy, that's something, Stephen, we all seem to wrestle with. And as our careers change, as our jobs change, we have to look at that differently. How do we manage those priorities? In finishing, in researching and finishing this book was a good example of this. It was fun, but it's also a challenging experience because we were doing that while we were also consulting and running our own business and coaching clients and trying to help. And it's not like we suddenly had 6 or 7 months with nothing to do. And so the practice that helped me the most was to schedule 2-hour writing blocks. And I looked at where my energy was the best. And one was from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. and one was from 3:30 to 5:30. That's just what worked for me. But during those times, what I did that was so hard was I shut off my phone. I shut off my email. I shut off all my texts. Nothing could ding and ring and bother me. And I just forced myself that I would have to write. And if I couldn't write, I'd look for quotes. If I didn't find any quotes that gave me any inspiration, maybe I'd edit the last chapter. If that didn't work, I would read. I'd just dedicate that time to making some kind of progress. And when the 2 hours was done, I stopped, even if I was in a flow, and it trained me to be ready, to be focused, and then move on with everything else so that I didn't get too far behind, really, with being responsive to my clients. And I've continued that practice throughout this last number of months, because what I discover, I don't know if you're this way, but too often I allow other people's priorities to fill my calendar so that at the end of the day, when I'm tired and I'm not really at my best, I then have time to focus on what's important. But blocking off chunks, just a couple of chunks during the day to work on my projects, has helped tremendously and really been a secret for me to get more done.
Well, what's really interesting about that is, one, how you guard your calendar. Two, it's aligned with your most productive and perhaps, you know, creative time. But also, you, even though you didn't say these words, it's built into that. And that is self-awareness. You identified when you're the best, these 2 2-hour windows, you know, in your day from 8 to 10 and from 3 to 5. And then you built that. But if you weren't aware of where your energy level was and where you were best, then you couldn't do that. So it starts back with self-awareness, doesn't it?
It really does. It really does. And the other thing that I think many of us want to pride ourselves because we think we're supermen or something is that we can multitask. But everything I read, Stephen, says we can't. All we're really doing is changing focus. And I'm addicted to the answering the email and checking off the task list and being responsive to a text or a tweet or whatever. And it doesn't serve me well in the long run. It's better if I deal with those when I'm maybe not at my peak, but still good enough. And that gives me a more creative time, deeper creative time to deliver those important things and keep the business going forward.
Love it. So let's take this momentum now and shift it, maybe just shift our context a little bit and maybe now look at it from the perspective of daily habits. So do you have a habit or two, Kendall, that you strongly believe have contributed to your success?
That's a great question. Maybe I'll stay with the planning routine a little bit. I'm a doer. I'm a task guy. I worked for Franklin Covey for years and taught the planning system and carried every planning system that there was. And so I have a bit of an urgency addiction versus an importance addiction. And so I noticed that when I don't do as well, is when I start my days by turning on my laptop and checking email and turning on my phone and checking voicemail and connecting with social media and finding out what's going on in the world. And when I do that, what happens is I quickly get consumed in tactical things versus strategic things. But when I start each day by grounding myself with what I'm about, what's the purpose of our organization, what are we trying to do, what are my own values, then what happens is it gives me a filter on what really is important versus what's urgent. We all have to do the urgent things. There's a client that has a problem and that will come first. Mm-hmm. However, many of the things that I discovered that I can push back that I thought were urgent, I was sacrificing for the important. So now I just put those, Stephen R. Covey called them big rocks. I put those big rocks into my calendar. And then as many times as I can, I force everything else around those. And 9 times out of 10, I can do that. But I get to make the choice. If there is something urgent, then I can adjust my calendar. So the habit that I start with now is grounding or trying to gain perspective. Some might call it wisdom literature or scripture or values, whatever that is, to give yourself a filter for what's important before you dive into everything else that's demanded of you?
Well, I love it that you took, you know, habits and tied it to habits. That's fantastic. Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, one of my all-time most favorite books ever. I think that Stephen Covey just really, you know, crushed it with that book. And well, 30 million copies were sold, right?
It's amazing how many people have been affected by that book.
Read it in 1997, changed my life forever. It's fantastic. And you mentioned working at Franklin Covey. Stephen's third son, David Covey, is a very good friend of mine. So it's a pretty small world too.
It really is. David is a great soul, written a new book recently and does great work across the globe with international clients. And, you know, Stephen R. Covey, we often said Stephen R. Covey wrote the book. His sons actually live the book.
Yes.
And that's a compliment to those sons who internalized it and made it part of their life.
Well, yes. And he and I have had conversations about, it's funny you mentioned that, about what it was like to quote unquote grow up Covey and what an experience that must have been. But so small world. Wow. It's awesome. Awesome. So great way to start us off. And now it might even feel a little bit abrupt, maybe even inappropriate, because we've got this really wonderful momentum that I want to flip this now and go 180 degrees in the complete opposite direction. And
you can't do that. Okay, yes, you can.
So Kendall, tell us about that challenging time, that situation could have devastated, maybe even ruined your business, but it didn't because you persisted by making the tough decisions. So now you can really look back at that once painful memory and say, you know what? That was a really invaluable learning experience. Tell us that story, Kendall.
Boy, I remember a time as a young consultant going into a senior executive of an oil company, and I was with a senior partner, and I was just trying to add value. I was desperately trying to figure out why I was there and what I could do to help this organization, and asked one of those dumb questions and walked out of the interview. And that partner said, basically, don't do that again. if you don't understand their business, then don't open your mouth and prove the fact. Instead, be a student of their business. Really understand their business. And I hadn't been a student of their business. As a young consultant, I was desperately trying to figure out my own business and trying to understand what do I do and how do I do it and how do I look professional while adding value. And so I think the first one was that I thought I might have got kicked off that project. Luckily, that senior executive didn't say anything and it wasn't that big a deal, but it taught me to be a student of my client's business. I think that's the first one. The second one that comes to mind, Stephen, when you ask the question is, early in my career, I discovered that we weren't as successful as I hoped we would be. In fact, research shows that 70% of new strategies of org changes of a new culture, anything that you're trying to roll out actually fails. And we were smack dab in the middle of that. We were failing, and that's not a good track record for a consultant, at least if word gets around. And so I spent time reading and trying different ways. And looking back on it now, I can summarize it this way, that many authors and consultants like me believe that change happens one of two ways, and they'll almost wrestle you to prove their point. One is that change happens inside out. It starts with the individual. We help the individual learn to fish so that she can fish for a lifetime. Other consultants, like strategy or design consultants, will come and tell you that in order to get a more effective organization, it starts from the outside in, meaning get your strategy right, get clear about your direction and your vision and align your organization. And what I discovered is that neither are right. It's not a dichotomy. It's not an either or. And after many years of considering the question and really doing it both ways, at Franklin Covey, we did it inside out. We trained individuals, trained an entire firm, and then wondered why the firm still hadn't changed. As a strategy consultant, I rearranged chairs and roles and responsibilities and structure lines and still didn't change. And now what I've discovered, then luckily had some experience in doing it so that change happens inside out and outside in, meaning I've got to work at the organizational level. I got to get that all aligned. I got to work with leaders so that they're leading in the right way. I got to work at the team level, getting teams on board as fast as possible. And I have to change individual behaviors and thoughts and attitudes. And if I'm not willing, if I'm not able, if I'm not focused on all three of those, then I'm going to stay with the 70% failure rate and wonder why. And so looking back now, I wish I would have known that 25 years ago and luckily figured it out so that I didn't keep failing on somebody else's nickel.
Well, I like your comprehensive approach. I don't know that I've ever heard anybody describe it that way in an inside out kind of matter. So it just seems much more holistic than maybe what would be viewed as kind of a traditional model.
Yeah. And I've pondered why you don't see that a lot. And I don't know that I have research to back it up other than my own career. But one reason is that there's a sucker's choice really for leaders. And it's an effectiveness versus efficiency choice. Many leaders in large organizations don't stay in their roles very long, 18 to 24 months. And so they're looking to make an impact, which leads them to do quick fixes, small fixes. Another thing that I've noticed is that in our education systems, in our leadership development systems, in our books, leaders are learning functional skills, but not learning how to pull all those functions together. So, for example, in my career, I learned how to be a good international marketer, but I didn't understand how strategy and international marketing, if it wasn't translated to the organization, I wouldn't have an organization behind me to deliver on those goods and services promised. And so leaders often don't have a purview into the larger organization, and we reward them for doing their day job. We don't reward them for looking at the big complex problems. We look at them for doing their day job and delivering on those numbers. So all of those factors lead us to efficiency over effectiveness, to optimizing functions versus the whole, to looking at pieces and parts and tinkering versus looking at the whole and looking to transform how all of it comes together. And that, you use the word holistic, that holistic view is something that I think successful leaders learn, and we have to help them or give them the resources how to learn it so that they can be even more successful in the long run.
Yeah, it's, I think, really powerful where you talked about, you know, efficiency over effectiveness. And it just reminded me of a quote from Peter Drucker, you know, the godfather of modern day management, who said something to the effect of, and I'll probably get this wrong, but something to the effect of, the worst thing you can do is the wrong thing efficiently.
Yeah. Yeah. You do it really well, but it's still leading you up the wrong tree.
Right. Right. So what would you consider to be the most critical skill you think business owners and leaders need to master in order to thrive today?
You know, I keep getting so much feedback around we don't know how to lead change. And if you look at that, there's so much out there. We've said it 100 times, but the rapid pace of change in our business world is causing many of us to not feel sure about how to lead our businesses. And so I think that this skill of learning to lead change successfully has to become as integral to a leader skill set as managing the balance sheet or implementing a new customer service program. But like I just said, if we don't have the perspective of that, what's going to happen is that we're going to try things here and there, and it's going to end up feeling fragmented or complicated or theoretical to those on the front line, and they're going to become disengaged. And leaders have to adopt a new approach. We can't just leave this leading a change to chance, or we can't delegate it to the human resource department or the organizational development group or the Six Sigma group. Really, what I've found is that to do that, leaders have to change two or three things. First, how they think and talk about change. You have to have big conversations. We have to have courageous conversations about what's getting in the way and what isn't working. And when we've started a business, it's our baby, and we don't want somebody to tell us that our baby's ugly and something isn't working. We just want it to work. And it takes a thick skin to have a big conversation with employees to say what's getting in the way. That's first. Second, I think leaders have to change how they engage the organization. We have to engage, like I just said, individuals and organization. We have to do both the inside out and the outside in. And maybe the third thing to get this as a skill set is leaders have to elevate the role that they play in change. And what I mean by that is we define leadership in so many ways. But how many times have we defined leadership as that I'm the chief focus officer, I'm the chief architect, I'm the chief engagement officer, I'm in charge of increasing leadership capacity, I'm in charge of sustainability. When I've seen leaders who really do put this on their leadership agenda and really try to be good at it, they almost change their business card, their description of themselves, and become those other chief officers, because that's what starts to engage and get buy-in and leverage the organization in new ways and helps them become that leader of change that they have to master and has to be on their leadership agenda.
You know, as I'm just writing this all down in my notes, what I love about that is that you really shined a light on when you talk about engagement and buy-in and all of that. It's so, I don't know what the word is I'm looking for. It's very sort of buzzwordy, right? I need to create engagement throughout my organization and get my team to buy in. But you just illustrated that the how behind that, and really also illustrated that it's hard work, but when it's done well, great outcomes come as a result of that, right?
It's so true. We did some research on employee engagement a while ago, and it used to be, Stephen, that we talked about employee satisfaction. And there was no correlation in employee satisfaction, the smile sheets and how happy we are, to actual business results. What researchers started to define was employee engagement, and now it's a buzzword. But what they're talking about is, are employees willing to go above and beyond? Are they willing to be that loyal advocate? Are they your number one fan? And it's been proven over and over again that those organizations with highly engaged employees outperform those with average or low engagement on all the things that are important, like net income and earnings per share and safety, et cetera, et cetera. And so if we keep it at a buzzword level, often what I still see leaders describing it is happiness, and we have concierge in the lobby and we change our menu, and all those things are nice conditions and environmental things in the organization, but those leaders that figure it out are really tapping into what drives motivation, the intrinsic things that drive motivation, like purpose and contribution and the ability to shape how I work and connecting with other people and delivering great quality work. And when I have those opportunities regularly, that's when I'm highly engaged. Research shows also, Stephen, that we don't leave organizations when we quit. We leave bosses. And if a boss, if an employer, if a leader can't create a climate that makes people want to stay and feel engaged, they'll find someplace else, especially with the new millennials.
So tell us about the most influential lesson, Kendall, that you ever learned from one of your mentors, and then how that lesson helped you become the business owner, the thought leader you are today.
I'm laughing a bit here because I reconnected recently or connected recently on Facebook with one of my teachers from high school. I took an advanced placement U.S. history class in high school from an amazing teacher named Don Ward. And going into the class, I thought I was a pretty good student. I had done well, and I was right in the pack with students that were performing well. And I remember writing my first paper for Mr. Ward, and he gave me a B minus. And I don't know that I had received many of those. And so I buckled down and I wrote the next paper, and he gave me not much better, a B, B plus, something like that. I don't remember how it exactly was, but I was frustrated, and I basically went into him and said, "What gives?" as respectfully as I could, and and told him, "Hey, I'm a good student, and look at all my peers who I have been with and gotten the same kind of grades they got. They all got A's." And he looked at me and he said, "I expect more out of you. I know what you're capable of." And then he said, "I knew how well your three older sisters did, and I expect that level of work." I was appalled. I protested in vain and said, "That wasn't fair. My sisters have graduated and gone to college. They're not even in the class. How can you rate me at that level?" But he expected more out of me. And guess what? I rose to the challenge. And that taught me, for me, that good was okay for others, but I needed to work harder until I delivered great work. And when I've been tempted to deliver good enough quality, I remember Don Ward and dig a little deeper. When we were finishing the book, I remember reading a chapter and thought, you know, I've struggled with this chapter a long time, and that's good enough. And I could just remember that interview in his office saying he expected more. And so I didn't submit it to the publisher. I wrestled with it for a few more weeks until I felt that Don Ward would be proud of it. So mentors like that that have caused me to see more in myself and dig deeper have really impacted me.
Wow. In that lesson, it's like I can see that happening and what that must have been like. And then I also hear the words of Tony Robbins, like, ringing in my ear, where, you know, he says, you know, raising your standards and what you expect is like the single greatest thing that you can do to live a better life and have a more successful business, raising your standards. And that's what your teacher really forced you to do. It's like, no, I know you're capable of more, and force you to raise your own standard. Would that be fair?
That's a great way to say it, Stephen. You're reminding me with that quote from Robbins. I had a baseball coach as well, and he chose us based on a different standard. Yeah, we had to be able to play, but he wanted us to show up as sportsmen. He wanted us to do service in the community. He wanted us to learn how to get along. And he held us to that standard. If he discovered when we were in the community doing things that maybe we shouldn't be doing, we didn't play. And again, I thought that was unfair. And he said, I'm not really raising baseball players. Some of you will go on. I didn't go very far, but I'm really raising men that I'd be proud of later to see in the community. And that was a surprise to me. I like how you're saying that's a standard. And I think as leaders, we have to do the same. We have to describe expectation of our employees from how they behave and how they show up. And we even, with some of our clients, use a thing that we call behavioral standards, where we describe what excellent looks like. So if you're on a customer service call, what's the difference between good and great? And if I were a fly on the wall watching and observing you, I could see what was good as great, good versus great. I could see it in behavioral terms. And I think that's what my baseball coach did, is that, yeah, he could tell whether you got a hit or you made the double play, but he was also talking about behaviors of being a good person, which we're doing in business. We're getting results. We're delivering good quality to the customer. But the leader has the most influence in creating the culture of the organization than anybody, by what she rewards, by what she values, by what she recognizes. And if we recognize good, I remember Jack Welch and the turning point for him. He had some amazing leaders, and we all remember kind of the urban myth and lore at this point of be number one or number two or get out. And the change for him and his leadership, I think, was when he said, yes, you have to deliver results, but it's also about living the values. And when he started to fire people that got results but didn't live the values, that was a wake-up call to GE, and it started to change the culture. And if we're not willing to do that as leaders, then we're going to get the culture that we value.
Yep, we get what we tolerate, don't we, Kendall?
Well said. Well said.
Wow. I know that our time is quickly coming to an end here, and I'm so grateful that you've taken time out of your compressed schedule. So before I ask my last question here, I just first want to say thank you. Thank you for accepting. Thank you for coming onto the show. Thank you for being so generous with your expertise and really allowing us to go deep into each of these really interesting and just exceptionally educational areas that you have taught to us. You've been an incredible mentor and just amazing conversation from beginning to end, my friend. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Stephen. It's really a privilege. You can tell I get a little excited about it it is brain candy to talk to you, because I love to talk about these things, and I can tell that your brain is thinking in ways that'll help all of those in Onward Nation. And so it's been fun.
I'm so glad to hear that, my friend. And so here's my last question for you. Give us a chance to go deeper into strategy, give you a scenario, and imagine you're standing in front of a room of brand new business owners, people just like you when you were starting out. So maybe they're battling their way through fear. Maybe it's worry. Maybe it's doubt. Maybe they're just struggling to try and find their footing. What would be two or three strategies you would recommend that they focus on to best ensure success?
Well, you don't ask easy questions, do you? if I'm thinking about standing in a room, maybe looking back as a young consultant, I'll put myself in those shoes, but I think it applies to leaders as well, is one of my mentors taught me early to have a framework for categorizing, analyzing, solving problems. Really a framework in your mind, a mental model, so to speak, of how organizations work and how all the pieces interact. I have one in my mind that shows the interrelationships that I've learned over time about stakeholder needs and results and gaps and what causes those gaps, anywhere from culture to process, structure, and systems, and where does mission, vision, values come in. When I was early in my career, all of those buzzwords, all of those concepts didn't have a place in my brain, and so they were separate pieces. But now when I go into an organization, I'm looking at the dynamics of how those come together, because typically that's where the problems are in organizations, and consequently where leaders are asking me how they should spend their time. And so that's what I do now when I go into organizations. I have a mental model of how they're getting results and what's getting in their way. And so I think that's what I would say, first of all, figure out what your mental model is for how organizations work. And then look at the interplay, the dynamics, the correlation between those, and that'll start to give you a holistic picture of how things come together or where things are breaking apart. I think that would probably be the first one. Maybe the second one, maybe I'll go to three. The second one might be spend time on employee engagement. Get people involved, create the environment of trust ask a lot of questions. We've heard about leading by, you know, managing by wandering around. Do that. Really connect. My daughter recently went to an interview, and in the interview, the CEO asked her a question, and she offered him a solution to a business problem. And I was a little surprised that she would have the audacity to tell this new CEO, who she didn't even work for yet, here was a way to solve one of the problems. And she told me last week that she was in the elevator with him, and he remembered. He said, I think your name is Nicole. You gave me a solution to this problem. Well, people aren't going to give those solutions if you're not asking and if you're not willing to listen. So I think that would be the second. And the third one that I've probably had to wrestle with the longest is own your own emotions. I think as a business owner, as an entrepreneur, it's easy to react to others' moods, their investors' issues, and many people find the negative of what's not working and all the problems that are happening. I think to be an entrepreneur, to be a business owner, you've got to be your own weatherman. You've got to not allow others to take away your power and not to try to solve all their problems or react to their issues, but own your own emotions and own your own proactivity, so to speak. Otherwise, you'll get drugged down at the end of the day with everybody telling you what's not working, and you'll forget what's working. I was working in the community and came home one night on a Sunday night and was down and had found all the things that weren't working. And my wife reminded me, she said, you know, you only deal with 5 to 10% of the problems. That's your job. 90 to 95% of the things that we see that's going on in the community are working great. And that was a good reminder for me that I needed to remember that the problems didn't define me or my mood, but really just gave me something I needed to work on the next day. So probably those three things.
Exceptional. Very well said. Great conversation. Like I mentioned a minute ago, from beginning to end, really deep, really thoughtful, precise. And there was just great context and depth. Just fantastic. Before we go, before we close out and say goodbye, Kendall, is there any final advice you want to share? Anything you think we might have missed, perhaps? And then tell us the best way to connect with you, my friend.
Well, that's a great question. I think maybe the last thing that I've been working on and seeing leaders that do this well and wonder how they do it is own your own education. I have a sister who never graduated from college and yet is one of the most well-educated people I know. And so read a lot, read magazines, read books, listen to podcasts like this one, challenge yourself to try on a new perspective. And I notice when I do that, typically the following week that a problem comes up and I can draw on something that I've recently read. And so we've been trying to write some of those blogs and create reading lists of some of those things. You can see, you can connect with us at changethewayyouchange.com. And there's some of the things that we read and write about and listen to this podcast for sure, because you'll not only hear what's relevant to your business, but Stephen, as I've listened to you, what I notice is that someone will come on, like you had a psychologist the other day, and I was wondering, why am I going to listen to a psychologist in my business? And yet how he approached his patients and how he listened and how he got deeper than just the spoken communication, I thought, you know, I could do that better with my clients. And so that's put me on a path of, I got to study a little bit more about communication to improve my own emotional quotient. So thanks, Stephen. It's been wonderful and a lot of fun.
It's been wonderful and a lot of fun to have you here, my friend. And Onward Nation, no matter how many notes you took or how often you go back and re-listen to Kendall's words of wisdom, and I sure hope that you do, the key is you have to take action on what he so generously shared with you today, apply it into your business, and accelerate your results. And Kendall, we all have the same 86,400 seconds in a day. And you are kind enough to come onto the show, to be such a great mentor, and to share insights and strategies and in research and background and process. And I am grateful for that, so that we could apply it and all move our businesses onward to that next level. Thank you so much, my friend.
Thank you. And thanks for what you're doing to help all of us be better leaders.
This episode is complete, so head over to OnwardNation.com for show notes and more food to fuel your ambition. Continue to find your recipe for success here at Onward Nation. ¶¶